You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Debt and credit are part of everyday life. We use our debit card at the store, we use credit cards online, and we take out mortgages and car loans to pick up expensive items. Payday loan shops advance us credit on our next check. But debt means interest. By the time most households have paid off their mortgages, they will have paid twice the amount of the initial mortgage. As for credit cards, interest can be as high as 28%. And the interest on payday loans is almost 600% in some cases. With all these credit tools around us, it's not surprising that the average Canadian family's household debt rose to $96,000 last year. To help us understand the rise of credit and the consequences, we're joined by Robert Manning. He's the author of Credit Card Nation, The Consequences of America's Addiction to Credit, and the founder of the Responsible Debt Relief Institute. Hello, Robert.
It's a pleasure to be joining you today.
Well, nice to have you with us. When did credit and debt begin to expand to their current levels?
Well, I like to refer to the 1982-83 recession as kind of the modern era, because there's been major events that occurred. Number one, a lot of the major banks circumvented state usury laws by moving to state legislatures that did not have interest rate ceilings, like Citibank moving to the state of South Dakota and Chase moving to Delaware. So at that point, banks could raise the interest rate to anywhere they wanted to go. At the same time, President Reagan came in and made inflation his number one boogeyman. So, of course, the profitability of credit cards suddenly soared. At the same time, the 1986 Tax Reform Act started to phase out the deductibility of interest on consumer credit. And, in fact, the U.S. Congress thought that would rein in people's spending. And, in fact, that didn't occur at all. But what happened is it created a loophole for things like home equity loans now that were tax deductible. And so people started to learn that they could take on debt in one form, like a credit card, and then they could start shifting it into other debts like a home equity loan, and then eventually a mortgage. And that, of course, was what presaged the foundation for the Wall Street engineering of collateralized debt instruments and eventually the collapse of the American financial system and then its repercussions globally.
So what were the specific policies that were put in place that enabled this expansion?
Well, the key issues here were that there was a 1978 decision that said that a bank could move to a home state, and that where their headquarters was located was where the interest could be charged. So if you were marketing to a state with an 8% interest rate cap on credit cards, but you moved to a state without an interest rate cap, you could charge any interest rate you wanted. And that really became now the musical chairs game of all these banks as they were consolidating, and what I refer to as the conglomeration stage of banking through massive cross-marketing, which credit cards created a huge opportunity because they were collecting so much financial information that the marketers that were starting to rise up in the ranks of the banks began to realize that they could understand what people were charging, they could have a better chance of influencing their behavior. So you start seeing this huge mass marketing campaign that emerges after the 89-91 recession, and the fact that it was far more profitable to lend to consumers through credit cards and other debt instruments than it was to major corporations. And that's where you saw the shift internally of major banks, where the focus and locus of power shifted from those who had relationships and lent to big corporations to those that were in the retail banking or lending to consumers.
The economist Richard Wolff has said that the growth in consumer debt has taken the place of the growth in real wages. Would you agree with that notion?
Oh, absolutely. I've done some statistical analyses, and you find out, of course, that in general, you see a substantial secular trend of decline in real wages, depending on sectors, in the early to mid-1970s. But interestingly, the biggest increase and the strongest correlation in the rise of household debt actually occurs under President Clinton, and it's occurring in the 94-95 period, where you see people taking on more debt, masking the decline in their real income and their real household income. And what's particularly striking is that in my analysis of the last three recessions, what you see is that each recessionary period sees a spurt in labor productivity that is rewarded those workers with higher wages. The 2001 recession is the first post-World War II recession where workers did not receive an increase in higher wages. And in fact, that's why the collapse of the American and repercussions in the global economy were so great, because workers did not receive their share of higher productivity in the early 2000s.
Now, we've also seen the rise of these kind of, instant check cashing services, sort of, payday loan style establishments. And they're very commonplace across North America. Can you comment on their growth and how that figures into to people's debt load?
Yeah, it's actually quite striking. And a lot of my earlier research, I tried to show basically the linkage of people in terms of their relationships to access to banks and the credit that they have. In fact, when you're referenced to payday lending, one of the biggest problems is that we're seeing more and more offshore payday lenders who are marketing over the internet, and nobody can figure out exactly who has responsibility of regulating them. And what we see increasingly is, as people maxed out on the easiest access to credit, like credit cards, the next available source of credit would be something like a rent-to-own store, a car title store, which were still secured loans, but then the payday lenders with interest rates of over 800%. And I should note that there are subprime credit cards, and I serve as an expert witness on many class action lawsuits where we've seen credit cards with the extra fees added on, that the effective interest rate could be over 800% in the first year.
Wow. What about this proliferation of credit cards on university campuses? What effect does that have?
Well, I did the landmark study on that in 1999, and the big issue here was that banks were looking at first people who were going to have higher income in the future, which were young college students, those who really hadn't gotten in debt yet, and those who they could influence their behavior in terms of their consumptive practices and their lack of financial literacy. And ironically, banks didn't want to lend to consumers that were in school at the beginning because they didn't think they could pay them back. So they basically pressured their parents to repay those loans. And that's where you saw in the late 1990s and 2000s, it was a circus on campus of trying to give away gifts to get people to sign up on credit cards, and it created quite a crisis of students who now were struggling to make ends meet and assuming what I refer to as competitive consumption on campus, because now universities were taking advantage of these credit cards to essentially extract more money from students that increased the cost of higher education. With the 2010 Credit Card Act at the federal level in the United States, you've seen a significant crackdown on the marketing practices on college campuses, and more of that activity now occurs online or through some very creative one-on-one marketing campaigns on campus.
Does this increasing debt load have an equal effect on people regardless of their income level, or are we seeing really a different effect of credit on people at the much lower end of the scale and people at the higher end?
Right. I mean, that's one of the big issues I've been working on now, particularly with the housing market, is a lot of people were trying to find the blame and accusing that, low-income people were responsible for the housing crisis that rippled through the economy. And the reality of it is that the lower-income families have the least access to credit, and it costs them the most. And once the economy started to slide, once they couldn't afford to make their payments, they didn't have any other credit, and the credit they had was so costly they needed it for basic survival. And that then is the reason we've seen the housing crisis slowly migrate up the socioeconomic ladder. I think the one point that tends to be neglected is that at its peak in 2006, Americans had over $5.5 trillion of credit on their credit cards, and that's been cut down to less than $2.5 trillion today. And while it may not seem like a lot when we're talking about a $10 trillion housing market, in many cases, cutting back on these lines of credit has created an enormous national domino effect, because people that would have used their credit cards as a bridge loan to survive until they got another job or to keep their house from foreclosure, once that was taken away from them, we saw hundreds of thousands of people immediately having no other option but filing for bankruptcy, and that reinforced the tightening of the credit spigot by American banks, and that's why we're not seeing a recovery here in the United States.
Another major aspect of credit is credit history. What's the significance of credit history?
You know, it's crucial. I've been doing a lot of work with universities and trying to explain to students that their credit score is more important than their grade point average. And the point is that the credit scoring system is being used in ways it was never intended to. It's viewed now not only in terms of your debt capacity and how much you can borrow, but also behavioral issues in terms of your financial prudence, good judgment, whether you're a trustworthy kind of person. And the reality of it is that the assumptions that are in a credit score are designed to enable the banks to charge you more money. They're not at all accurate reflections of people. For example, immigrants who pay in cash, who are very credit worthy but don't have much credit, have a very low credit score. Divorced women, et cetera, who haven't had much credit history but are very trustworthy in terms of their ability to manage their household finances, they get low credit scores. And in fact, we've recently designed an alternative objective financial credit score, which we expect will be used as an appeal to people who have been rejected for a low FICO score but know that they can afford to rent a home or to buy a house.
Now, with the financial crisis in the United States, I believe some reforms of the banking and credit industry have been enacted. Have these been affected?
Well, no. I mean, the banks and their lobbying. I mean, unfortunately, in this phase of the American recession, the most profitable arena now in Washington is lobbying and versus affecting real change. And so the banks now, beginning with the Durbin Amendment, which capped the amount of fees that a bank could charge on debit cards, they've had this huge campaign with Bank of America raising levying a $5 fee on people who use debit cards and trying to blame all this on Congress, and that further regulation is going to further restrict access to credit. And instead of really pulling together as the American government and taxpayers save the current banking system, now there's this huge backlash to basically push back any reforms on the U.S. banking system.
Well, it's been really interesting talking with you about this this morning, Robert. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be joining you.
I've been speaking with Robert Manning. He's the author of Credit Card Nation, The Consequences of American Addiction to Credit, and the founder of the Responsible Debt Relief Institute.